Good afternoon, everybody. Board members, my name is Greg Wood. As Ms. Bertocci said, I am the director of the Division of Water Quality Management. And I'd like to, first of all, start with going over some very general concepts and terminology to help you understand how we assess proposed discharges, whether it be from this facility or any other facility, and how we assess whether the impacts or lack thereof to the receiving water. So what I'd like to start with, if it's okay with you, I only have three subject matters. I'd like to start with the difference between technology-based limits and water quality-based limits, because that is discussed at length. All discharges are subject to the requirement that the effluent limitations that are required must have the application of best practicable treatment, and that's right in state law. In addition, further on down in that section in the law, it actually describes what best practicable treatment is. And I'll just read from the law. Best practicable treatment means the methods of reduction, treatment, control, and handling of pollutants, including process methods, and the application of best conventional pollutant control technology or best available technology economically achievable for a category or class of discharge sources that the department determines are the best calculated to protect and improve the quality of the receiving water and that are consistent with the requirements of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act or the Clean Water Act as amended and published in the 40 Code of Federal Regulations. And then also part of that, it says if no applicable standards exist for a specific activity or discharge, the department must establish limitations on a case-by-case basis using best professional judgment after consultation with the applicant and other interested parties of record. So I want to start out with best practicable treatment. So best practicable treatment essentially levels the playing field for a class of dischargers. And it does not actually dictate what the hardware is for the treatment. It actually dictates what the concentrations and or mass numbers are going to be coming out of a treatment plant that represents something that is affordable to a class of dischargers. And let me try to give you an example of what I mean, and I'll try to keep this thing local. So the Belfast Wastewater Treatment Plant is required to provide a secondary level of treatment, and technology standards in our rules and in the Clean Water Act require that for biochemical oxygen demand and total suspended solids, that they're required to meet as a monthly average 30 milligrams per liter and 45 milligrams per liter, as well as an 85% removal rate. So it doesn't matter if this treatment plant, which is required to have secondary, is in Belfast, Maine, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, or Kansas City, Missouri, they have to meet 30 milligrams per liter and 45 is a monthly average and a weekly average respectively. So it levels the playing field for all people. And another example would be the Northport Village Corporation. They are one of probably 15 to 20 facilities in the country that did get a waiver from secondary treatment. And best practicable treatment under federal regulations is the 30% removal of BOD and TSS. So they're not required to meet the 30 and 45 milligrams per liter. They're required to meet a percent removal. That's BPT for primary treatment facilities. And just to give you the context of where these folks actually perform, for the city of Belfast, their removal rates are on the order of 95 to 99% removal of the BOD and TSS coming into the treatment plant and then leaving. And Northport, even though it's only required to achieve 30% removal, actually achieves a 76% removal rate for BOD and a 90% removal rate for TSS, so which is pretty darn good. Now, there are also other types of technology-based BPT standards or technology-based limits, and they're found in national effluent guidelines that are published by the federal government. And a good example that I can give you would be a pulp and paper mill. For BOD and TSS in those permits, national effluent guidelines actually establish X number of pounds of BOD for every ton of production. So what we would do if we were writing a permit for a paper mill, we would j- just multiply the number of pounds of BOD times their production numbers, and we'll come up with what the technology-based limits would be for that facility. So that's just generally speaking how technology-based limits are established or implemented. And then what we do is we take those BPT limits that we have calculated, and we will send them over to our Division of Environmental Assessment, and they'll take those numbers and model those values to try to find out if those loads going into a receiving water can actually meet water quality standards. If they do, then everything is fine. We issue the permit as a technology with technology-based numbers. If they don't, then we need to go revisit what is the threshold in which you would have to limit the permit so that you don't have a violation of water quality standards. And let me give you a very brief example, and that would be the Androscoggin River with Gulf Island Pond. So just north of Lewiston and Auburn, there's a very large dam there that slows the water down. And above that, feeding Gulf Island Pond, is a medium-sized wastewater treatment plant at Livermore Falls. And then there are two large paper mills upstream from that. What happens there is that these discharges pile on top of each other and they all end up in Gulf Island Pond. And the monitoring Gulf Island Pond over the years has showed us that there were dissolved oxygen problems in there. It was not meeting standards. And also there were algal blooms in there because of excess phosphorus being discharged. So we had to assign water quality-based limits to all three of those facilities so that Gulf Island Pond would meet standards. So those are the differences between technology-based limits and water quality-based limits. The next area I want to go into is mixing and reasonable opportunity for dilution. And again, I'll refer back to the law. Section 451 of Maine law says the purpose of a mixing zone is to allow a reasonable opportunity for dilution, diffusion, or mixture of pollutants with the receiving water before the receiving water below or surrounding a discharge will be tested for classification standards or violations, excuse me. So there are rules that that give us guidance on how to establish near-field dilution factors. They're pretty clear, but there also is a requirement that we evaluate far-field dilution to deal with different parameters that have different response times. And that's the last section I want to get into is this response time, because it's very important how we assess different pollutants. So you have there are some pollutants that have very short response times. An example would be chlorine, temperature, or say toxics. Those effects can happen within hours or single days after being discharged into an environment, depending on what the concentrations are. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. So I had a friend who wanted to go fishing one time, and he went and got some live bait at the local bait shop, brought the fish home, and decided that he wanted a different container to take his fish in. So he turned on the garden hose, filled up his container, threw his fish in there, and went fishing. By the time he got to his fishing hole, all the fish were dead. And so he couldn't figure out what was going on. Well, what he did is he actually lives in a community where he is supplied by a public drinking water supply. And as Mr. Parker said earlier in the day, there's very, very high levels of chlorine in that water. And to put it into perspective, most drinking water supplies will have anywhere from 500 parts per billion to 1500 parts per billion of total residual chlorine to make sure they maintain proper disinfection in their distribution systems. The freshwater acute criteria for fresh water is 19 parts per billion, and for marine water, it's 13 parts per billion. So he put his fish in chlorine levels that were 50 times higher than they could actually handle, and he just didn't understand it because he thought it was just water coming out of the faucet. So that's something that I would consider to be a short-term response. Now, there are other parameters that we're dealing with in this facility and others, at this proposed facility and others, and that would be the longer response times, and that would be associated with things like biochemical oxygen demand, which usually takes 5 days to exert its impact on the environment. And nutrients can be anywhere from 13 days to 14 days, or maybe even further than that. It all depends on what the environmental conditions are in the receiving water. So I just wanted to put some terminology and some perspective on how we actually look at these kinds of things. Does anybody have any questions so far?
I don't see any, so you may proceed.
Okay, so what I want to do is just kind of walk through those major points that Ms. Bertocci just put on the screen a little while ago, and I'll just go down in the same. I'm going to be very high level. I'm going to stay at the top of the trees. If you guys want to get down in the weeds, I do have other people on the phone here that can help me out, our water quality modeling engineer and our marine biologist. But let's start with temperature. Temperature was a subject that was talked about quite a bit at the hearing. And in our assessment of temperature, we utilized the highest temperature value that Nordic put in their application, which was 18 degrees C. They don't intend to discharge, according to their application, they don't intend to discharge if they are granted a permit. Will be discharged between 13 and 18, but usually right around 15 degrees. But we wanted to look at the worst case scenario. So we evaluated it based on 18 degrees. And there is a seasonality component to the regulation. You can't change the receiving water by more than 1.5 degrees between June 1st and September 1st. And that, I'll call that the summer season. And the non-summer season, you can't change it by more than 4 degrees. And changing the ambient, it says no discharge of pollutant shall cause the monthly mean of the daily max to be changed by more than that. So they're looking at daily maxes, the monthly mean of the daily max ambient conditions. So what we used was, again, the 18 degrees centigrade, which is 64.4 degrees Fahrenheit. We used, for summertime, we used 10 degrees C, which is 50 degrees in the month of June. So it's usually from June 1st to September 30. That's the coldest part of the season. And then in the non-summer season, we use 1.3 degrees centigrade or 34.3 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's in the month of March where the temperature are the lowest. We did those calculations, and we calculated the temperature change in the receiving water based on the parameters that I just explained, and concluded that if a permit were approved for this facility, that they would meet the temperature standards in the summertime and in the non-summertime. Anybody have any questions on that so far? Okay, hearing none, let's move into dilution factors, which is this reasonable opportunity for mixing. So like I said, when you're looking at near field dilution, we have a regulation, Chapter 530, which is Surface Waters Toxic Control Program, and it makes it very clear how you calculate dilution factors in the near field for both freshwater and marine. The applicant in their application did that and suggested that the acute near-field dilution factor was 10 to 1 and that the chronic dilution factor was 15 to 1. We reviewed those modeling results and agreed that that was a reasonable thing to do. What's a little more difficult is assessing the far-field dilution. There is no state guidance or federal guidance on how to calculate far-field dilution. There is some talk of it in the technical support document that we cited in this memo, but it's not very clear, and they essentially leave it up to the regulating authority to use best professional judgment on how to do this. So the far-field is less clear. So in a November 3rd, 2019 amendment to the application for a waste discharge permit, the applicant created a graph that showed how they were looking at the far field dilution. This gets a little complicated, so I'm trying to make it very simple. So it's our understanding what they did was they took, and I'll just use ping pong balls. They took this circulating model that they had, and they were taking particles and actually mathematically putting them into the water and trying to find out after 2 days what was the dilution associated with each one of those particles. And they created four graphs. And one of the graphs, which they used to calculate their dilution, far field dilution factor, was the 50th percentile, meaning that 50% of the particles were greater than X dilution factor and 50% were lower. And they did this out over 20 days long. So they kept tracking what was the dilution associated with particles that were 2 days old. And based on that, the applicant indicated that the far field dilution factor in their mind was 300 to 1. And the department misinterpreted what they were actually saying, because we interpreted that as being the mean. Again, we're going to go back to response times. The response times are anywhere from 3 to 14 days. They were looking at 2 days. So they're already conservative in that sense, is that they were looking at a shorter response time. And that 300 to 1 that they identified as being the far field dilution factor was actually the lowest dilution factor associated with any of the 2 day particles. And the department would not look at it that way, and we would look at it as a longer term averaging rather than taking the absolute lowest dilution factor on that. So we misinterpreted the graph that the consultant sent to us. So when we wrote this memo and used the 300, again, that was based on a misinterpretation by the department of the graph that they had submitted. So we looked at that graph a little closer, and if you look at longer averaging times, we've estimated the dilution factor be more on the order of 530 to 1, which according to the graph is 10 times 2 to the 7th power. So we were overly stringent in our review of this because of our misinterpretation, and we think that the applicant was way too conservative because that would have been inconsistent the way we look at these far field dilution factors and have been for the last couple of years. So we would recommend that 300 to 1 is too stringent and that 530 is a more appropriate far field dilution factor. So we would have to modify the calculations that we did in our memo. Are there any questions so far?
Thousands. A lot of that math went over my head, I'll confess right now. But why don't we simply proceed from here and see if there's any other questions that are more clarifying than I can ask. I see none, so I will try to catch up.
Okay. So let's proceed to effluent monitoring and ambient water quality monitoring. I think one of the misconceptions at the hearing was the issue, if this facility were to be issued a permit for the proposed discharge, that the department would just evaluate this the way we have here and then just walk away, and that's not what happens. When MEPDS permits are issued, they're issued with limitations, special terms and conditions, and routine monitoring requirements. And those routine monitoring requirements can be at a frequency of once a day to once per year. So they, permittees monitor their effluent every month. They summarize their results. They give us the raw data and they submit it electronically to the department and EPA, who has oversight over the program in May. We are a delegated state, but EPA still always has the oversight. So we go through all of the data every month, and we have a committee here made up of people who are in the compliance section, the enforcement section, and the permitting section. And we go through all of the discharge monitoring reports, is what they're called. We go through them every single month, and we look for non-compliance. And what we're really trying to identify is, are there chronic compliance problems out there or not? And are our facilities actually meeting all the terms and conditions of their permit? And so we would see nothing different if you were to issue a permit for this proposed facility. We would see that to be no different than any other permit that we issue. And as far as ambient water quality monitoring, it is not uncommon for MEPDS permits to have conditions above and beyond just establishing either water quality based limits or numeric limits and the routine monitoring, to have actual ambient water quality monitoring to help the department and the permittee understand what's actually going on in the receiving water, especially if there's any question mark or there is just insufficient amount of information. So if you remember, with the permittee has actually drafted a applicant permit which did have a number of ambient water quality monitoring conditions in it, and there, if a permit were to be issued, they are agreeing to do things like a dye study and to do ambient water quality monitoring at stations that the department has already done some ambient water quality monitoring at. And so this would add to have a more robust database for what's actually going on in the receiving water. And it'll they have also agreed to do a dye study. And I think if you remember at the hearing that Dr. Pettigrew, who was, I believe, hired by the Upstream Watch or representing the Upstream Watch's concern, did have a conversation with the modeler from Nordic. And I think it was agreed that doing a dye study would be helpful for everybody to try to understand what's actually going on in the bay and actually try to get to verify or refute the dilution factors that we're talking about, because there is, as I said before, an awful lot of best professional judgment when it comes to these, especially the far field dilution factor. So it's my understanding that these folks, again, based on the permit that they drafted and submitted to you folks, that they're willing to do that ambient water quality monitoring.
I hate to interrupt briefly here, but do I understand correctly that this would be before any construction takes place? They do the dye test out where the discharge will be, and that'll inform us?
No, they would not be able to do that, because in order to do that, you have to have the flow going. We have to have flow going out of the water. I mean, out of the discharge pipe,
right,
in order to be able to do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So, are there any questions on ambient water quality monitoring or effluent?
Mr. Sanford has one. We're not hearing you, Mr. Sanford.
I have a question, Bob, if he knew hear me.
I thought I heard a pen click.
Jim. It's Jim,
yeah. I wasn't quick enough.
Okay. All right, Rob lost his place. We're going to Mr. Parker, and then I'm coming back to Mr. Sanford.
I had a real quick little question, Greg. As you talk about the dilution factor. They had 300, you wanted like 570. But in the literature we were sent a few days ago, we said 1,000 to 1.
No, that was, no, the far field dilution factor to assess the impacts of nitrogen and BOD on dissolved oxygen in the receiving water were based on the 300, which we're going to call now five, we're proposing 530. That 1,000 to 1 was the dilution associated with looking at the eelgrass as being an environmental response indicator. That is that is much further away from where the far field dilution is.
Okay, I'm back with you. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Sanford.
This is Rob. Do you see a distinction between proposed conditions or activities that the applicant is offering versus some that you think need to be done to make a positive finding?
I think that the conditions they have proposed are sufficient. I don't think there are any in there that we would go above and beyond. I think that we could answer any questions that we need based on what they have proposed.
Okay.
So do we want to go to nitrogen now?
I have a question or two, and maybe this is not the right time for it. One of the things that was a major discussion was the configuration of the bay itself, how much water is sloshing back and forth so that, yes, you have dispersion, but then it all washes back into the next tide, and you have, with certain weather conditions, the opportunity to pile up some of these factors so that all the ping pong balls are coming back together again or never dispersed in the first place. How much confidence do we have in that modeling at this point?
I think I'd like to divert that conversation or that question to our water quality modeling person, Mr. Moeller.
Okay.
Rob, could you weigh in on that, please?